I'm Claire Daly, and you're listening to the Bloomsbury Institute podcast, recorded live at Bloomsbury Publishing in Bedford Square, London. For details of our future events and to listen to all of our other podcasts, go to www.bloomsburyinstitute.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, that's... Can you hear me at the back? Through the reverb. Okay, I've just shut this window to my right, but if you find it's getting a bit stuffy, do say, and I'll reopen. Once again, good evening. My name is Bill Swainson. I have the great honour to be an editor of Anthony Grayling's books, which we publish at Bloomsbury. And tonight it's a very great pleasure to welcome you to the Bloomsbury Institute and Hatchard's Book Club to discuss with Anthony Grayling his latest book, The God Argument. But before I begin, there's a little bit of housekeeping and announcements to be made. So first of all, I'd like to formally thank Hatchard's for being our partner in this enterprise, and Claire Daly, the Bloomsbury Institute's event manager, for organising everything. And she has asked me to mention that our next event will be an evening with Patrick McGrath in May, who will be discussing his new novel, Constance, with his editor, Alexandra Pringle, who's the editorial director at Bloomsbury. And then the housekeeping, Anthony will be very happy to sign copies of his book, The God Argument, at the end. So, please join me to start with in welcoming Anthony Grayling, leading public professor of philosophy in Britain and very important writer and public intellectual, to the Bloomsbury Institute. Now, for those of you who have seen a copy of The God Argument, if you turn to page 3 of the prelims, you will see a list of previous publications that's almost indecent. If you remember that Seneca said that a man could probably only read 3,000 books in his lifetime, and he was talking about books as they were then, which were more like parchments and scrolls than substantial books like The Good Book, which is a hefty 600 pages, and is connected, as we'll discover as we continue our conversation, to Anthony's new book, The God Argument. And what I thought we would do to start with is I'm going to ask Anthony a few questions, and that might take us slightly less than half the remaining time. The remaining time takes us till 7:30, at which point pumpkins and things of that kind come to mind. Mm-hmm. But so half the time we'll roughly do that, and then there'll be a good long time for the questions that I'm sure you would like to ask Anthony about his book and possibly some of his other books as well. Now, this book, The Good Book, was published a couple of years ago, and we've just reissued it, and we decided that a book as substantial as this couldn't really have a paperback edition, at least not for a bit yet, but it could have a cheaper hardback edition, or a more affordable hardback edition, and that's just come out at the same time as The God Argument. And it was a wonderful book, a very ambitious enterprise, which was to go back and take from the tradition of what one might call classical humanism coming forward into the present to create a book that would be, if you like, a Bible, a secular Bible for those who did not belong to the Christian faith or the Islamic faith or the Jewish faith or any of the other religious faiths in the world, but nevertheless took their ethics and the way they lived their considered lives seriously. And around the time that Anthony was delivering that book, he began to talk about the idea of doing a book which eventually became The God Argument. So my first question to you, Anthony, is what was the origin of the book before our conversation about it, and why now, not earlier or later?
Well, two main motivations. One is everybody's conscious of the fact that for the last decade or more, there has been an acerbic, rather bad-tempered argument between people who don't have a religious outlook and people who do. And there are a number of people like Christopher Hitchens, the late lamented Hitch, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, other people who have written books which are critical of various aspects of the religious outlook. And in some cases, they've been pretty frank and robust. That's one way of putting it. Their opponents have regarded them as rude and offensive and rebarbative. And I suppose the change of tone in the conversation was affected really by the events of 9/11, the atrocities in New York and Washington on that date in 2001. So the tenor of the debate has been rather sharp, and it's been quite polarizing. A lot of people who might have had something of a religious outlook have, you know, firmed it up a little bit and come out of the closet and said that they've got it. And other people who hadn't given it much thought became worried, I think, about the fact that there appeared to be a recrudescence of interest in religion, and particularly sort of activist forms of it. And so it has been a polarizing debate. And in this book, The God Argument, one motivation was first to try to step back a little bit and look at the overall picture. My sort of colleagues on the non-religious side of the argument had attacked different aspects of it because they had different motivations. Christopher Hitchens, for example, would sometimes describe himself as an anti-theist as well as an atheist. That is, he was opposed to those sorts of theists, perhaps evangelical Christians and more activist Islamists. And he was politically and socially opposed to them. Richard Dawkins, who for many, many years had been trying to explain to people the methods and assumptions of the natural sciences, and in particular the importance of evolutionary biology, kept on bumping into people who thought that the world was created in 6 days, 4,000 years ago, and irritation has accumulated in him over those decades. And as a result, of course, he does sometimes seem to be rather tough talking. Dan Dennett was very interested in the psychological aspects of religion, why people believe, and how that might be explored. And I wanted to try to do something of a conspectus, to talk a bit about some of the assumptions which are already accepted in the debate. Just to give you one example, people talk about arguments for the existence of God or the place of the idea of God in their lives and so on. And they use the word God with a capital G as if it were a name, as if it named something, as if there were a subject matter. And perhaps the quickest and shortest way to describe what I try to get at by exploring how the debate is approached is to tell you that my youngest child, my daughter, Maddie, whom Bill knows, I'm bringing her up an atheist. That means it sounds terrible when I say that, especially in America, there are gasps in the audience that are doing her harm. I bring her up to ask people questions about why they believe things, what their evidence is, what reasons they can give. And I say to her, whenever you get into these conversations, don't use the word God with a capital G as if it were a name. Use the phrase gods and goddesses. So you can say to people, why do you believe that there are gods and goddesses? And usually people say, well, I don't. And then they say, well, why does the arithmetic make a difference? You know, if there were one, why couldn't there be more? And if you didn't believe in more, why do you believe in the one? And so on. But I also ask her that if people insist on using the word God as a name, that they should instead use the name Fred, so that you get them to say things like, the universe was created by Fred, or that Fred tells us that we must love our mothers and fathers, and so on. And then you see the explanatory value, if there is any, in these undefined or ill-defined or very capacious notions which haven't really been pinned down. And so part of the discussion has to be, what are we doing when we try to think in these terms? And so part of the argument there is really to explain that a great deal of the background of thinking in discussions about the nature of theistic beliefs has to be explored, because even before you get to the familiar arguments for the existence or otherwise of a deity and what people actually believe substantively in their religions, quite a lot of territory has already been yielded to the debate. So I'm sometimes asked to debate sort of theological issues by people like William Lane Craig. The last time he invited me to debate with him, I said I should be very happy to do so if we could have a preliminary debate, and the preliminary debate would be, on the existence of fairies. Now, when I say that, people think I'm being flippant and unkind, and I'm not, because those of you who have read about this will know that belief in the little people, doesn't matter what names they had, you know, leprechauns or fairies or pixies and so on, was extremely widespread and very serious. People really believed that they existed. And you've all heard of the old Irish lady who was asked if she believed in leprechauns, and she said, "I do not, but they're there anyway." So, you know, there was this very, very persistent deep belief right up until the end of the 19th century. One reason why the Church of England founded primary schools was to combat a superstition about the little people, an irony for you. And they were regarded as being responsible for curdling the milk and stealing your shoelaces and pinching you at night in bed and giving you the egg. So if you challenge somebody and said, "Do you think there are fairies and pixies and goblins, and are there any at the bottom of your garden?" And they say, "Well, no, of course not." And you say, "Well, why do you think not?" And then you listen to the reasons that they might deduce for not thinking that there are such beings. And then you say to them, those arguments, if you export them to the case of theology, are exactly the same arguments and exactly the same reasons. And the difference between the two is that we've forgotten the tradition of thinking about the little people, but the tradition of thinking about the major religions and their theological tenets continues. And it's the weight of history, not the weight of argument or of evidence, that lies behind the continued belief in these things, or belief that you believe those things, or people wanting to believe those things, and so on. So that's motivation for the first part of the book. But the second motivation, and in a way the more important one, is that I wanted to talk about the alternative. Because a lot of people say, if you don't have a religious outlook, what view do you take of the world and of what it is to live in this world and to relate to others? What's the basis of your ethical outlook? And there is a rich, deep way of thinking about these matters with its roots in classical antiquity, in the great conversation that reflective and educated people have had about matters of principle and of how one lives one's life, which for convenience, but not inaccurately, I think, could be called humanism, perhaps with a small H. And I wanted in the second half of the book to talk a bit about that, to try to explain what that might be, and to set out some ways in which a humanistic perspective on matters of society and ethics might look in connection with the great debates that we have with ourselves about moral matters.
Right. Now, I remember reading an earlier book you wrote, Anthony, called What is Good, which is, if you like, it's a history of ideas of just what Anthony's been talking about, that Western classical tradition of philosophy that comes from ancient Greece and then reappears in Rome, before, as it were, going underground in the 3rd century BC, when Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, and stayed that way for about 1,000 years, roughly speaking, before that tradition, if you like, re-emerged in the Renaissance. So I have two questions for you. One is, can you tell us that particular story, what happened there? And then one of the interesting things about the ideas that surfaced in Renaissance was they seem to surface partly, perhaps because of what you're going to tell us about the re-emergence of that tradition, but also a felt need that there were things missing from the Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us a bit
Indeed.
About that?
Well, if one looks back across the landscape of debate about ethics, and one looks in particular at the classical period in ancient Greece, the time of Socrates, you see that a conversation was started reputedly by Socrates, going around Athens, challenging his fellow Athenians to address the question of what sort of people they should be, what kinds of lives they should live, what values should shape and inform the way they thought about themselves and their relationships and their society. And in what is perhaps the first really great classic of discussion of ethical matters, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and in the post-Aristotelian school, Stoicism, Epicureanism, really for almost 1,000 years, right up until a bit later, the 3rd, 4th century maybe, of the Common Era, when Christianity became the dominant outlook of the European mind, this tradition of thinking premised itself on the idea that our outlook, our thinking about how to live and what regulates our behavior, did not premise itself on the idea of a divine command, that something from outside was imposed as a challenge or an invitation to think and behave in a certain way, which of course is the premise of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which includes Islam, which is a syncretist outcome of the Judeo-Christian tradition. But instead, is premised on the idea that we as human individuals have to take responsibility for thinking about these matters and for discussing them with others, for, as it were, negotiating with others how we organize our relationships in society, but certainly to think a bit about one's own commitments and how one's going to live. When Socrates challenged his fellow Athenians with that question, he didn't ask them, what interpretation do you place on ancient scriptures, or what do you think the gods require of us? Of course, they, as a sort of reflex matter, invoked the gods, and Socrates used to say, my daimon tells me when I shouldn't do something and prevents me from doing something. But the premise of the discussion, you see it most clearly in Aristotle, is how do we, using our practical applied wisdom, navigate our way through situations of dilemma? How do we cultivate in ourselves the sorts of virtues, the attitudes to life that would make of us people who live in this flourishing and well-doing way? And he came up with the idea of what, in Greek anyway, sounds absolutely appalling, the megalopsychos, sounds like something in a horror movie. In Latin, it's magna anima, in English, magnanimous, the magnanimous individual, the great-souled or great-minded individual who thinks with generosity and care about the route through any situation of dilemma. Now you notice that this is for the individual himself or herself to work out, to think, to take responsibility. And this is what humanism is, because it says we human individuals have this responsibility, and we have this responsibility for our fellows in the human realm, and everything is at the human scale, between birth and death, this life, in this world, and how we deal with this world. And I should add a little footnote here, because I'm often asked in talking about humanism whether it includes animals too. And the answer is yes, animals are humans too. I speak as a vegetarian, so I'm all for including the great apes in the moral sphere, and that we should treat chickens and dogs and everything very well too, so it's not exclusive. So that's that debate. And then you look at the discussion through Stoicism. The Stoic outlook was the outlook of educated people for nearly 1,000 years before Christ, or nearly 500 years, I should say, more accurately, really. Before Christianity became the demanding outlook, after all the heresies and so on, as they were described, had been more or less overcome. And that outlook, the Stoic outlook, was one which in its essence is very simple. It says, with respect to all those things you can't yourself control or influence, you must have courage. So aging, disease, tsunamis, earthquakes, you must face them with courage. But with respect to your fears, your desires, your appetites, you must try to achieve some degree of self-mastery. And if you could live with courage and with self-mastery, you would be living a life of dignity and nobility. And this is the best kind of human life, a noble life. And it's a very simple, but it's a deep and rather beautiful idea. Of course, it has a lot of other aspects to it as well. But again, you notice that it is a humanistic idea. It doesn't say the gods require of us that we behave this way or that we must believe something in order to survive some test which is being imposed on us. Very, very different outlook to morality. And so after Christianity, of course, like Judaism, represents the moral life as a response to a challenge or an invitation. We are created, as it were, ill. We are fallen. We are sinful. We need salvation. Salvation is offered us through the atonement of Christ, the sacrifice of Christ. It gives us an opportunity if only we will believe and accept that our will is a fallen and a prideful will, so we must submit our will to the will of God. Not my will be done, but thy will be done. Islam, by the way, also means submission. So the idea of giving oneself, dying to oneself, giving oneself over to the deity, a very, very different conception. It's polar opposite conception from the one says, think for yourself, be responsible, take responsibility for your moral choices and your moral life. So it's a very interesting contrast. In the Renaissance, many of the people who had rediscovered classical literature, poetry, and the philosophers, and read them and began to apply them to their own life, were themselves Christians. So in the Renaissance period, you get this hybrid of Christian humanism. The great humanist of that period, of course, is Erasmus, widely admired and widely read in the Renaissance. But by the Enlightenment, two or three centuries on, the religious aspect of it had pretty well been shed, partly because the philosophers of the early modern period had recognized that the argument that Plato put in his dialogue, the Euthyphro, it's known as the Euthyphro problem. Are the gods good because what they say legislates the good, or are they good because they obey the moral law? If the gods are good because they obey the moral law, then we need to know the moral law independently of the gods. But if the gods legislate the moral law, then this is a bit of a problem, because what happens if they said it's good to murder and rape? What would our reaction to that be? So this sort of contradictory problem had been identified by Plato, but it came back full force in the early modern period, leading people to think that independently of what religious moralities have to say, we need to think again about the principles and basis of the moral life. And of course, as soon as people started to do that, think of Hume, Shaftesbury, Immanuel Kant, think of the great thinkers, Hutcheson and others of the 18th century Enlightenment, you think of Diderot and the editors of the Encyclopedia when they addressed these questions, there was no need for a theistic underpinning. In fact, on the contrary, the argument was put that if you're being good because you want to get into heaven or because you think you're being watched by an invisible policeman, or you know, if those were your reasons, then your reasons are not reasons of principle, they're reasons of prudence. And prudential reasons are not logically compelling reasons for being good. You know, it can be summed up in the crudest way by, unless you do this, I'm going to beat you up. Well, the threat of being beaten up is not a logically good reason for doing something, except in the sense that it's prudent to do it. So the philosophers recognized it, and we notice, therefore, that debate about these matters since then has been sort of richly informed by the classical conception and not by the not so much by Christian moral theology. So that's really the overarching picture about the history of broadly speaking humanistic thinking, which has these roots very, very deep in the classical tradition.
Well, let me then take you back to Periclean Athens, because Periclean Athens is however complicated it may be, and however imperfect our understanding so many hundreds of years later may be, there was a sense of a functioning society with all its limitations. It was a democracy for a small number of people within the total society and so on. But it wasn't a city devoid of gods. So one of the questions that comes to mind is, in the same way in which there seems even now to be the discussion about what the role of religion might be in the public square, perhaps a good place to start with that theme is, what was the role of religion in ancient Greece, and how has that changed down the years? Mm.
It's a very, very interesting topic, this one, because of course there is a major disjunction between what people understand by religion in the Judeo-Christian tradition, which premises the concept of a personal relationship between a god and an individual, and what one which might be mediated through prayer and through experience of the divinity in one's own life. And what was meant and understood by religion, and what functions it performed in pre-Christian classical societies. If you look at Rome, for example, Rome treated religion as a public affair, which had as its chief importance the social cohesion of the empire. There were many, 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 many different superstitions and religions and practices and observances and beliefs across the empire, but the great overarching festivals in which the emperor was regarded as divine, in which Jupiter or Juno or any of the major gods were sacrificed to, these were great public affairs, great moments of ritual and fate, and they were, as it were, external. They were social endeavors. They were like, you know, FA Cup sort of thing, or test match cricket or something. They were big public affairs. And the very word religion, those of you, we all of you, of course, were practicing your Latin verbs in the bath last night, so you'll remember religio, religere, the same word that underlies ligature. It means to bind or to bring together, so to bind society together through these public observances. Greek religion, however, is closer to the roots of where the proto-scientific and experiential aspects of religion lie. And to explain that, if we go back a little bit, you'll notice that Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions are very, very recent in human history. They're very young religions, these. And for tens of thousands of years beforehand, what we think of as religion now was a form of or different forms of animism. We can see this in the residues in Greek mythology, for example, mythologies of the Middle East. You can see them in what used to be called contemporary Stone Age societies, not quite sure how they're described these days in PC terms, but animism there. You look, for example, at Greek myths, you see the nymphs and dryads are actually in the streams and trees, and the Poseidon is under the sea, and Zeus is on the mountaintop from whence he throws his lightning bolts and so on. These are personifications of the forces of nature, and they arise in the animistic view from the projection from our own felt capacity as agents. You know, you can pick up a stone, throw it into the pond, there's a splash, the ripples move away, you've made something happen in the world. So the thunder, the lightning, the growth of the plants, the movement of the sea, there must be an agency involved in making this happen. So this is a sort of proto-scientific attempt to explain things in terms of action, of agency. Ego, agere, acti, actum. Okay, so making things happen, doing things. And you'll notice that there is a kind of geography. You know, the nymphs and dryads were in the streams and trees, but as our forebears in remote history got to know more and more about nature and its regularities, so the deities moved away from their presence in the immediate environment up to the mountaintops, and mountaintops are regarded as very sacred. In the Old Testament, Moses meets God as a burning bush on a mountaintop. He was also a pillar of smoke by day, so he might have been a volcano god at some point in the history of the tradition. Olympus was a mountain, so high mountains were places where the gods were. When people got to the mountaintops and they found the gods and goddesses weren't there, they moved into the sky. And now that we know that nowhere is up, because we live on a globe, they've gone beyond space and time altogether. So there's been a kind of movement by the gods beyond the horizons of our ignorances as we've learned more and more. And it's rather interesting to see. And that fact has to be laid alongside the origins of the mystery religions in ancient Greece, Orphism, for example, which were ecstatic religions, and the use of drugs and alcohol to get people into altered frames of mind. It's almost certainly the case that our early forebears had experiences like being in a fever, having an epileptic seizure, eating a magic mushroom by mistake, consuming fermented grains also by mistake. And you can imagine in those circumstances, you really think you've met the gods, haven't you? Because, you know, everything, you've broken through the veil of normal reality into some altered state of consciousness where you may very well have met these agencies whom you believe operate the forces of nature. I had the personal suspicion that there was some bloke, and it's almost certainly a bloke, who thought to himself one day, if I can persuade my fellow members in the tribe that I can communicate with these agencies and even perhaps, you know, suggest to them that they bring the rain or stop the rain if there's a flood, and they believe me, if my fellow tribe members believe me, then I am going to get all the girls and the money. And this is almost certainly one motivation for organizing religion a bit. And then, of course, the temporal powers would find religion a huge ally. Because if you can tell people that there's an invisible policeman or set of policemen watching you when you're on your own, even on your own in the dark, you have a means of influencing, controlling their behavior. So you can see lots of reasons, metaphysical, proto-scientific, social, how the origin and development of religion could be reconstructed like a kind of Nietzschean genealogy. And the residues of it are in Greek mythology. All the forces of nature and of psychology are personified in Greek myth, which is why it's so wonderful. You think about the story of Cupid and Psyche, or you think about the operations of the major gods, you think of a god for each of the really important, significant things that happen in our lives, and you can see this as an explanatory framework. Whether people like Plato and Aristotle and others literally believed that they were such agencies, or whether they recognized that these were just utilities. And then after all, Plato did say that hoi polloi, that's the masses, ought to be encouraged in their religious beliefs because it was a good way of keeping them in good behavior.
Now, there's something that follows from that. I mean, many, many things follow from that. But I want to take you back to, you talked about sort of goblins and fairies and superstitions. And in the, let's go to the 17th century in England, and we're in the 1620s, and Milton is sitting down to write on the morning of Christ's Nativity. Mm-hmm. And one of the key moments in that rather wonderful poem, which is a celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ, is a lament that's written into it for everything that has to be given up if you believe in that. And in that poem, some of the most moving stanzas are about the gods fleeing from Mount Olympus and the nymphs and dryads from the streams and the woods and so on. So hold that in your mind for a minute. And then we're also in 17th century England, and you've got a whole set of traditions which we know from, in one form, from the Shakespeare plays, and you think only of Mercutio's speech in Romeo and Juliet about Queen Mab, and a world which is governed by a mixture of superstitions and trying to explain the odd things that happens, why the milk curdled or the cow kicked over the pail or whatever it might be. These things turn up all over the place. And the question I want to ask you, Anthony, is if Milton could write such a moving section of that poem celebrating the birth of Christ's Nativity about what was lost in the form of classical mythology, and at the same time Puritanism was kicking, if you like, sort of what we would now call country superstitions, if you like, out of the public square. Can you talk about those two things in relation to the way in which many people feel a sense of hurt at the idea of having to give up the idea of religion and take on the responsibility of decisions for themselves?
Well, there are a number of different aspects to that, and it's an important question. I've often thought, by the way, in connection with Milton, who, after all, visited Galileo when he was travelling in Italy, that his sympathies lay with Satan. You know, so when he inserts things like that into poems, you feel a sense of his nostalgia for a quite different way of thinking about things. I mean, not Satan, with Lucifer in Paradise Lost. I think that there are some onion layers to the answer to the question. And one obvious one is that some sense of transcendence, of the mystery of the world, of the poetry of things, of the numinous, of the interconnectedness of all things, of our capacity, one of the best things about human beings is our ability to respond to that sense of the greater largeness of things and some holistic response that we have to it, which is partly emotional, partly intellectual. I think it's a remarkable thing about human beings, which we describe by using the word spirituality, that we have this spiritual dimension to us. Humanism, non-religious, non-superstitious humanism, I think has a very good take on this matter, because it says what we would suggest to people is to think about how we can reclaim all those things that we put under the rubric of spirituality, using that word in a non-supernaturalistic sense, by redescribing the simple, beautiful, refreshing things that people do, like going for a walk in the country, or listening to music, or looking at art, or reading, best of all, having dinner with friends, something like that. But to redescribe those as things that do feed and nourish the complex of our emotions and our attitudes. But these things don't just belong to church on Sunday or to places which are designated or set aside as being holy. So that would be one humanistic response to a very natural feeling that people have. But the other thing is, and here one must be a bit more reductive, the other thing is that you can explain to anybody, any religion, and its tenets and its major beliefs and what it offers in less than half an hour. I challenge anybody to find a religion where it takes longer to do it than that. It takes some years to understand physics or biology and to really see what the world is like. Let me give you one example. You know, in the funeral service, we are told dust to dust. We were told indeed in Genesis that Adam was made from the dust into which life was breathed. We know now from biochemistry and from cosmology that human beings are made of heavy chemical elements which were formed in extremely high temperatures. The only place where such high temperatures could be found to make the heavy elements are stars. So human beings are quite literally made of stardust, of stuff that was formed in stars. Not the dust of the ground, but stardust. Now this is the difference between science and religion. Science is so much more exciting, so has such greater poetry. I mean, you know, if you read a bit of cosmology or physics, you find that the world is a much more amazing place than was ever imagined in any of the texts. You know, when people say, where are the references to televisions and Ferraris and so on in the Bible? That there is a kind of reductive, you know, joke in that, but it's also a point that the way the world is imagined in the religious traditions is actually far less interesting and far less rich than the world is seen, conceived, and understood in our explorations of it in the natural sciences and elsewhere. So that's something that what people regret is the simple, neat closure that you get from a religious story. Religion will tell you where we come from, what we're to do here, and where we're going. It has a kind of narrative structure to it, which human beings love. We like narratives. We like a sense of finished explanation. And a lot of people who have a real need for that kind of thing find vertiginous and troubling the open-endedness, the lack of answers, the inconclusiveness of the scientific enterprise, which whenever it comes up with a new way of thinking about things, thereby generates a whole lot of more problems. And we seem not quite to know, understand enough about the universe. People who invoke Fred, you know, that individual who provides a kind of closure, if we don't understand it, well, it doesn't matter, Fred did it, you know, that kind of answer, of course, explains nothing. And so the open mindset, which says, well, we're full of ignorances and it's exciting because we can go on and try and find out more, is rather different to the more comfortable, comforting, sort of poetry-laden, attitudinal way of looking at things, which is what religion provides.
Thank you. Now, on that note, we're two-thirds of the way through our time, and it's time for you to ask the questions. So if anyone would like to ask a question, raise a hand and the microphone will be brought to you. One in the front row.
As we touched on science, my background is science, and I came to be an atheist out of my understanding of science. I just couldn't accept religion anymore. But I kind of sometimes wonder, I meet other atheists who basically are atheists because they can't deal with the problem of evil, but they don't know very much about science. And I kind of find that seems to me totally incomplete. And I was wondering what your opinion is on the path to atheism, and is science a requirement, a knowledge of science, a good knowledge of science?
I think a good knowledge of science is a desideratum no matter what, because after all, this is one of the, if not the greatest achievement of human ingenuity and genius, to have come to the understanding we have so far about the great and the small, and to apply some of that via technology to our lives. You know, sometimes when people are feeling particularly rude about religion, they say, well, try lighting and heating your house by prayer rather than by connecting to the electricity and gas supply, the latter, of course, of which is the outcome of scientific investigation and control of nature, and the former of which, well, of course, there's that story, isn't there, about the man who wanted a Ferrari. He prayed and prayed for one and it didn't turn up, so he realized that's not how prayer works. So he went and stole one and prayed for forgiveness and thought that was a much more productive way of doing things. And this does capture something of that contrast between ways of thinking about the world. There are many routes to both to religion and to atheism, or rejection of religion. And a lot of people are very compelled by the argument from evil, especially natural evil. That is the existence of things like childhood cancers and tsunamis and so on, where there seems to be no justice, no discrimination in the great harm that nature does to human beings from time to time, or to sentient creatures. And they find that inconsistent, the idea of omnipotent being, unless that omnipotent being is not a good being.
One halfway back.
You mentioned in the at the beginning that part of the response after 9/11 with a sort of more vocal atheism was that it would turn some people more vocal about their religion. So there's a sort of schismogenesis of people getting more tightly into their views. And I think whenever one asserts any position more vocally, that's a likely consequence. I was working with the Uganda humanists last year and the year before, and you could see that there was so much more Western influence in the last few, even just the last few years. So there's obviously this gay rights debate ongoing, but also religion itself being questioned, more pressure on pastors and so on, and on traditions, African traditions being questioned, people saying, oh, you know, maybe this is wrong. And in fact, one of the consequences, perhaps as a consequence, child sacrifice, that superstition is on the rise in Uganda. It's not going down, it's actually increasing. So how can we talk about humanism and atheism in a way that does not risk that pushing away, that hardening of religion? So much so that some people who aren't of religious can become more fundamentalist and more
And witchcraft as well, the great controversy over witchcraft in Africa as well, seems to be much, much more visible now than it ever had been before. Two things to be said about it. One is it's inevitable that when a debate gets out into the open and people start taking positions, naturally enough, they get a bit harder line. They become more invested in their position. And so you do get the risk of things escalating in both practice and in assertions of belief. But the second thing to say about it is that one anxiety that people might have, or hope that people might have, is that the religions in the world are recrudescing. They're, you know, rising up again, or gathering numbers and gathering strength. And people point to the growth of Christianity in Africa, for example, and the power of the churches there as evidence of this. But there is contrary evidence, most notably in the United States, where the Pew Center produces polling data every year and now show that about 20% of the US population tick the none box, N-O-N-E, when asked about their religious commitment. So they're known as nuns, which is rather appropriate. And under 35s, now over a third of under 35s tick the none box. And this trend has been increasing over time. So when you look at the figures for the last quarter century, for example, you see that what is a very religious country where the religious lobbies have a powerful voice, things are moving in the secularizing direction more and more. So it could be that the increase in amplification of the religious voice and the increased zealotry in some quarters is a response, is evidence not of growing religiosity in the world, but of the embattled nature of people who have a religion. You know, if you've got an animal in a corner, it'll make a bigger noise than it did before. So if it's on, if a movement or an outlook is on the back foot, it might become more vocal and strident as a result. Of course, you could say that also about secularists and atheists, because they've been more vocal and strident as well, except for this. But quite literally, and we're in a publishing house here, and the publishers can tell us this, quite literally, not scores or hundreds, but thousands of books are published every year of one or another kind of religious nature, all the way from theological treatises to books about how to pray, to books about how Jesus can transform your life, books about how my three-year-old saw an angel, and so on. So there are thousands of such books, and yet less than a dozen books by people like Dennett and Hitchens and Dawkins in this last decade have caused this enormous furore. Why? Because it's touched the nerve. It's really touched the nerve. A lot of people out there who feel threatened by the fact that the respect agenda has come to an end. You know, it used to be the case before 9/11. If you met somebody who had a religious commitment, you kind of pussyfooted around them. Somebody once said very well that when you met a dedicated Christian, you treated them like somebody who'd had a recent death in the family, which is a bit sort of apropos. So you would, you know, treat them with a kind of bit of tenderness. And generally speaking, civilized religious folk would not push it down your throat at a dinner party. That seems to have changed. Now people are out and proud on both sides of the argument and, you know, taking a stand. And in particular, the expectation that I have a faith, I'm committed to my faith, and therefore you must respect me for my commitment, that sort of comes to an end. What? You believe all those things? How can that possibly be? And that, so now people feel a bit challenged by it. Here in the UK, we've seen evidence recently of Christians saying that they feel a bit persecuted, not allowed to wear their crucifixes to work and all that kind of thing. Now, actually, of course, Christians like a bit of persecution. A little bit of martyrdom is a good thing. They're bearing witness, you know. Not too much, of course. It's a kind of comfortable level of persecution here, which is that people disagree with them. But quite often, people of religion will say to me or to another, used to say, the things you say are very offensive. You offend us. You trouble and upset us. And I always respond by saying, when you guys were in charge, you didn't offend us. You just burned us at the stake. So things have moved on a little bit. Now the conversation has a different tenor.
One right at the back there.
Hello. I don't know whether you've read Alan de Botton's Religion for Atheists, Mr. Groening, Professor Groening, but in it he's sort of arguing the point that religion, there are some good things from it that the humanist secular society could learn from in the fact of the celebration of and the continuing discussions about virtues on a daily basis through the lessons of the church, architecture, music, etc. But he's still saying that obviously his point of view is that religion is a sort of past subject. But in a humanist world and society, where do you sort of see the organized rituals and traditions and social occasions where people can celebrate things and remember the virtues that people actually should celebrate? What's your view on the book, I suppose?
Perfectly natural, understandable, and indeed admirable need that human beings have to mark great occasions, weddings and funerals and the birth of a new child, welcoming somebody into the family, celebrating success, getting your degree, you know, publishing your first book, whatever it might be. These are natural and good things about us. And we do them all the time. There are dinner parties and graduation ceremonies and humanist weddings and humanist funerals. I mean, you don't need religion to be able to do those things. They're a natural expression of what human beings need. In fact, the religious observances are outgrowths of this natural human propensity, not the other way around. So that if, which is not likely to happen all that soon, but if religion were to vanish, we would still be doing these things. We'd still be saying, let's get together on Saturday afternoon and name this child, or get together on Sunday afternoon and graduate our students, or whatever. We would do it because we need it, we like it. We're social beings, and we need our social get-togethers, our rituals. Things like if you were a certain kind of sociologist, you would regard cocktail parties or get-togethers like this one here, or a dinner party, or people going to the theatre together as being part of the rituals of our lives, the way that we relate and structure our lives. So we do it all the time. What I somewhat deprecate is the "I'm an atheist, but" movement. You know, I'm not religious myself, but. You know, there's always a but, dot, 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 so we need something. And the great fallacy that lies behind the religion without God movement, and by the way, my late and much lamented friend Ronald Dworkin, died just a few weeks ago, as he was in his final illness, he wrote a book called Religion Without God, which comes out in the autumn. And I sort of completely understand why people might think that some structure is required to help people think and practice, you know, some commitment, some joining up. And there are people who need a particular kind of joining up. But the reason why the 30 million atheists in the United States of America are nowhere near as influential as the 60 million evangelical Christians is that whereas the evangelical Christians all get together in mega churches and put their money together, if you've ever been to one, you'd be surprised how many times they're asked for their money during a service. They put their money together, they can lobby, they've got radio stations and television stations. The 30 million atheists tend to be equal to one person, Why? Because they're all independent-minded. They're not joiners. They don't get together and bang the atheist drum. And when people talk about atheist churches or get-togethers, they should be reminded of Auguste Comte and positivism of the 19th century. That was the most terrific damn squib to try to have a non-religious religion. It's a mistake. It's aping something where actually you should see that all those needs and all those interests are already being very well catered for. If only you would see them in that light and re-describe them.
Yep, another one at the back.
Hello. Can I just get your view on this? I don't know who said it, but there's the saying that if people stop believing in God, it's not the case that they stop believing in the otherworldlies, that they'll believe in anything. And do you think there's a risk that if people stop believing in organized religion, they'll start worshipping stones and sun and all the other nonsense? In other words, you've gone from one set of nonsense to another set of nonsense.
Yeah, that does happen. There is a kind of a transition period when people find that they can no longer believe in one or another of the traditional religions and of a personal deity. They have a spell in the feng shui tendency. They might buy themselves a crystal or two. And, that does happen. It tends not to stick there. Eventually people end up getting to a point where they really have to confront the question of what they think and what they believe. And by the way, this is a major problem. A lot of people believe that they believe. A lot of people have got a big, thick Chinese wall between their normal daily rationality, where they can cope with their bank account and conduct their daily lives well, and then they think they believe in some pretty extraordinary things, like virgin births and resurrections and three in one and all sorts of things that the tenets of their religion. And if they really examine them, they really seriously try to get down to a consistent logical examination, their only resource in order to stop confronting the result of that thought process is to put it behind the veil of mystery. It's all a mystery. Our finite minds can't understand it. It's ineffable. And what they don't realize when they do that is that therefore anything goes. That if they're going to put it behind the veil of ineffability and it can't be understood, then they might as well believe that there are 17 and a half Martians tucked away in every politician and that is running the world. And then you might as well believe that, because the control, the logical and evidential control you have over your beliefs has just gone. So if you're going to put it behind the veil of ineffability, believe anything you like, because anything follows. And that's a great problem. So people do find, if they confront it, I'll give you one little example. A couple of years ago, BBC asked me and Richard Harries, who have been the Bishop of Oxford, to do a program called The Atheist and the Bishop. And I was the bishop on that occasion. And we went to a Church of England school in South London, a girls' school. And we were going to inquire into the difference it made to the girls at this school that they were at a Church of England school, secondary school. And when we got there, the headmistress said to us, we encourage all our girls here. We've got mainly Anglican girls, but we've got some Catholic girls and some Muslim girls, and we found an atheist girl in the sixth form. And we encourage them all to respect one another and to allow one another the difference of belief. And I said, well, are you saying that so that we can praise you for it? Because that's the least we would expect of you. But if you want to be praised, I'm going to ask you whether you get these girls to think all the way through to the end what they believe, right to the end of their commitment. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, suffer the children to come unto me and I will show you what I mean. So they brought me a Catholic girl, an Anglican girl, a Muslim girl, and the atheist. And I said to the Catholic girl, I said, your church teaches that there is no salvation outside the church, that repudiate the Holy Ghost, which is the message about the atonement of Christ's sacrifice for you, is a terrible blasphemy. Now, if somebody has rejected that message and doesn't accept Christ as their Savior, what's going to happen to them when they die? And she said, ooh, I'd rather not say. And I said, well, go on. Well, your Muslim friend here, she's following a false prophet. She doesn't accept the divinity of Christ and so on. What's going to happen? She said, well, I'm afraid she's going to go to hell. These were friends, these two girls, by the way. They walked to school together and did their homework together. I said to the Muslim girl, the Prophet, peace be upon him, says there is one God, not three, not three in one, but just one. And Muhammad is his prophet. And if you accept that, you're a true Muslim. And this girl thinks that Jesus was divine, was actually God himself, and so on. She's got it all wrong. What's going to happen to her when she dies? I'm afraid she's going to go to hell. So I said, what's going to happen to the atheist girl? And they all said, well, she's going to go to hell. And they were all agreed on that. It was the one thing we got consensus on. Now, the headmistress and Richard Harris were horrified. They said to me, what are you doing? You're sowing dissension and strife, and you're making them all think they're all condemning everybody else to hell, and this is a real problem. I said, no, I'm not. I'm just getting them to think right the way through to the end of their commitments and get them to ask themselves the question, do I really think that? This is my friend. I do my homework with her. Is she going to go to hell? Why? Why was she going to go to hell? What does all this mean? What's the logic behind this? If you were really committed to believing it, how could you? That's what I wanted them to see, if they could. And the problem in our world is that people don't think about it. They don't really think about what they're being asked to believe or what they think they believe. And in fact, even in the United States of America, you must remember what happened when Howard Dean was trying to get the Democratic nomination in 2004. He'd been the governor of somewhere in New Hampshire or somewhere like that, New England, so he wasn't a religious man. He was told by his minders that when he went to the southern states, he had to make a religious remark, but that would be part of the story. So he planted a question in the audience. Somebody in the audience is going to ask him, what's your favorite book of the Bible? And the person who was going to ask him this question got it wrong and said, what's your favorite book of the New Testament? And Howard Dean had already prepared an answer, which was the book of Job. So the person said, what's your favorite book of the New Testament? He said, the book of Job. And nobody minded. Nobody even noticed. That makes you wonder just how much people really know about their own religion. Have they really read the Bible? Is a question you want to ask them. What do they think of the story of Lot and his daughters and blah, blah, you know? You just wonder whether people understand what they think they believe, or whether they really do, or whether they think they do, or whether they want to, or whether they have what's sometimes called the non-cognitivist attitude, which is that going to church and seeing yourself as a Christian and singing the hymns and being with other people is what it is. That's your religion. And actually, the actual content of the beliefs, you're prepared just to not consider them.
And I think that on that note, we can bring the evening to an end. And if you do have more questions you'd like to ask, Anthony will be going back to the conservatory where we started, and we'll be happy to sign books, but also you continue the conversation there. But it only remains...
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, you can. You can have an extension of 60 seconds.
Yeah, I should have said earlier on, because it's a very, very important point, this, and I mustn't forget to say it, that humanism is not a doctrine, it's not a teaching, it doesn't have a code or a prescription or a set of do's and don'ts. It's an attitude. It's an attitude which says, let us begin from our most generous, most sympathetic understanding, such as we can get an understanding, of human beings, of human nature and the human condition. Let's notice that history, literature, philosophy all attempt to explore what the human condition is, all our frailties and failings, all our struggles to try to love well those people we care about, form good relationships in our societies, to do something which adds some sort of value to experience, not only our own, but that of other people. It's an attitude, it's a starting point. And each one of us has different talents for doing that, so there might be many different ways in which a life could be good and well lived. There's not a one-size-fits-all, that's what religion tells us. And then right the way through history, most human beings, and even in the world today, most human beings are told there is one great truth and everybody's got to believe it and everybody's got to live according to it. But that's a distortion because of the great variety and diversity in human nature. And humanism says, understand yourself and then do your best. And it might be very different from other people. You remember what George Bernard Shaw said about the Golden Rule? Golden Rule says, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Shaw said, you mustn't do to other people what you'd like them to do to you, because they may not like it. And it's a very, very good insight. Don't be the benchmark or the standard for what other people want and do, but see them as individuals. See human plurality and diversity as one of the great goods of our experience, and start from there in thinking how to live well. End of sermon.
Thank you very much.